Session number 12933.
Mr. Weston, the six. You were saying the German farms weren't like the British ones.
The German farms were absolutely beautiful. They were well maintained, not like the ones at home in the 20s and 30s, where the kind of farm where I was born near, which were dilapidated, and they all disintegrated. And a lot of their owners went abroad, Malaya. All their farms were in beautiful condition. And when I was going along the road looking at the crops, beautifully laid out, the height of the crops, I couldn't believe it. And I remember turning around to somebody and saying, why the hell do they ever want to go to war when they've got this, such a beautiful country here? I can't understand it.
Did you have anything to do with the German population?
Only at the farm we stayed in Germany. We did stay at a farm there. What I found was they had the greatest respect for their own services, their own troops. They had the greatest respect. Poor old Tommy has never had very much respect unless he's wanted. Between the wars, after the war, between the wars, he never gained very much respect from the civilian population. Over in Germany, it was entirely different. All their latrines were all dug for them. All the other little jobs, everything, which we would consider absolute chores and what have you. We found all this done for us. We weren't used to all this, but they had the greatest respect for all their servicemen, and they gave us that respect, I suppose, automatically. We treated them as we would treat our own people. We were ordered not to fraternize, and we didn't. Not that they wanted to fraternize, they didn't. They were polite, and we were polite. They were having a lot of trouble with displaced persons who were armed and who were roving the countryside. And while we were stationed in that farmhouse, we were sent out in groups to guard German houses. Some of them were a bit more than houses. They were small mansions, as it were. But there we were with a defeated enemy in his house with Tommy guns at the ready, waiting for the knock on the door or waiting for some disturbances from people who were going around the countryside looting with weapons that they easily got hold of course. Displaced persons, they call them. And they were defending the enemy against looters. Funny old world, isn't it?
Were you long in Germany?
No. No, we were rapidly recalled, and I left 41 Commando. I was sent back to England, to Petworth Camp. And I joined 45 Commando, and we were on our way to fight the Japs.
Now, there's just one final thing I'd like to do, if possible, because I know that you were in at the liberation of Hong Kong. Can you tell me what you saw
Well,
in?
I wasn't in at the liberation of Hong Kong. We arrived in Hong Kong after liberation, and we moved up into to the frontier.
When would this have been? How long had it been liberated for? About months or weeks? Yes, according to the form you've kindly filled out here, it says 4th of September 1945, from then onwards. But I interrupted you with you saying what you did in Hong Kong.
When we arrived in Hong Kong, it was the commander brigade. We were due, of course, to go into action in Malaya, presumably. We were welcomed over there by on the way on the route by Earl Mountbatten, who came on board and gave us a pep talk, welcomed us into Southeast Asia Command. But by the time we gone much further, of course, the VJ Day came. When we arrived in Hong Kong, we disembarked and marched through Kowloon, to the centre of Kowloon, and in a very regimental manner. It was observed that a lot of the Chinese, well, some of the Chinese were having a bit of a giggle at us, and what we understood was it was our green berets, because we always wore our green berets all the way through from D-Day onwards. We never wore steel helmets. And in China, it had to have something with jilted husbands or boyfriends. And they thought that they rather saw the funny side. They had a great sense of humour, the Chinese. And they thought that we were all jilted lovers or husbands or something, and we've been because we were condemned to go to Hong Kong or something. Anyway, our destiny was just outside Kowloon, and we got ourselves sorted out there. But before long, we were in trucks heading for the new territories, where the communists were on one side of a stream and we were on the other side, and joining it, the communist empire with ours, was a wooden bridge called Chick's Bridge. And there was also a railway connection at Lo Wu. We were assigned to the border patrol. Between us was a very shallow stream, nothing like seen today with barbed wire or wire fences. And it was very open territory. We had a troop headquarters, and it was Lee Ma Hang, and we had another little outpost further down with a Lewis gun on the roof, and we had a Union Jack flying on the top, and one room where we slept, ate, and everything else, and a little cookhouse on the side. That was a section headquarters, and that's where I was at one time, and our job was to observe our section of the border and take note of any movement on the other side. And there was really masses of empty space really on the place opposite us, almost a great valley with mountains on the other side. On our side it got more mountainous from where we were. We had Japanese prisoners then to do most of the dirty work for us, which was rather a change again on the abolitions and everything else. And they actually took over almost the quartermaster's store, I believe. They were extremely disciplined, and I wouldn't have trusted them 2 inches, but they were very, very sort of humble, and an awful lot of bowing and things going on, but that attitude can soon turn very quickly to exactly the opposite if it's given the opportunity. But the ones we had with us there, they conformed extremely well and did all our chores, and they were very well looked after, of course. We, very luxurious for us, from the life we've been used to, we found that the local Chinese who had known the British Army since time immemorial, the Dobe ladies came along and took all our washing. We didn't have to do any washing. This was really luxurious. And the local chaps came along who'd served the British Army, and they knew how to clean all our equipment. So in the sergeant's mess, yes, I was a sergeant by then for some accident. We had one sort of flunky between two of us, and he did all the cleaning of our brasses and badges and everything else. And we were really living in cuckoo land, as it were. But we had a serious job there, and the job was one to keep an eye on the communists just across the road, and we had to be very careful to avoid punch-ups, and we had to be very careful to be ready to get into slit trenches if they were very light on the trigger. And they always used to have their bayonets fitted with their rifles, rather like the Russian rifles, those long bayonets. They were always fitted, and they always looked as if they were ready to take a pot shot when it suited them, and sometimes they did.
Did the population in Hong Kong seem to be glad to see British troops arrive, the British power come back, or not?
Very difficult to say when you've only been there once. Very difficult to say. See, the Chinese, like a lot of Orientals, I wish there was one in this country doing very well at the moment, this line. They do not show emotion, and they do not show feelings very much at all. But we certainly had no hostility. You see, mainly when the Japanese took over Hong Kong, as I understand it, it was the British who were really taken apart. Even nurses and that were raped and what have you. And, you know, they did some unforgivable atrocities. But I don't know, I can't see any reason why the Japanese should have really been, had the same attitude with the Chinese, because after all, they were going to have to live with them, weren't they? And I didn't hear of any atrocities had been taken against the Chinese.
Was there any disorder in Hong Kong whilst you were there?
No. One of our jobs was smuggling. Because, you see, we were getting a lot of flour into Hong Kong to feed the population. Now, the local law lords, and of course China had they've got all these triads, I suppose they were all there then, and one of our jobs was patrolling. And what they were doing is, instead of this flour, which had come a heck of a long way and cost a lot of money and everything else, staying in Hong Kong and being bought by the local people, the usual gangs were smuggling it to China, where it fetched very high prices. And to pay for this, of course, coming the other way was drugs. In all this poppy seed stuff and great sticky masses. I don't know whether they called hashish in that stage or what. I've forgotten.
Opium?
Yeah, opium, yes. So, yeah, there's all this stuff. So they were paying with it, the drugs. And we used to patrol the borders along the sort of mountain. They weren't mountains, they were fells. And we used to do fell racing there to keep fit. You know, rather like they do in the north of England. But they were sort of small mountains, there were these fells. And when darkness came, you used to get strings of coolies setting off across the paddy fields in devious routes into these fells, which are very difficult to police, carrying, as they do on their bamboo canes, jogging along, 400 at a time. There's no messing about, counting one. And coming in the opposite direction was all this, all these drugs to pay for it. And what we used to do was, on dark nights, we used to lie up along some of the tracks, not very far from that, just lie up along the tracks in the dark and wait for them to come paddling by. And then, when we'd got the last one, when the troop was, that was it, more was at the, right at the front, had got the last one of the string coming from China, he'd blow a whistle, and we'd all jump up and try and grab somebody in the dark. Well, of course, they used to scatter everywhere, and of course, we used to be outnumbered. But we used to end up with tons of this darn stuff, tons, in our little station. That's the sort of job we were on. And in the other way, going into China, we used to search the trains going over to make sure that there was no flour on the trains. Now, most of them were open carriages, and a lot of people were going, you know, used to go from China and back again, and it was, what have you. And I remember once when we searched a truck, there was a dear lady there who looked as if she was pregnant with twins. But looking at her age, I mean, I don't know how old she was. I mean, if she'd have been European, we'd have given her age as about 60 by the wrinkles on her face. But being Chinese, she was probably a lot younger, obviously. And giving her a prod and everything, you see, it was all flour. I mean, all the tricks of the trade were up to. And that was one of them. The number of pregnant women going back into communist China was amazing. To think they could get away with it, but well, some did. But it was rather pathetic in a way. But of course, we had to be tough on them, and they had to because their standard of living was, of course, extremely low and very low indeed.
I think you were telling me that that Chiang Kai-shek came through with his forces
the Nationalist Army. That's right.
Into Hong Kong. Can you
That's
describe
right.
that?
Pardon?
Can you describe that?
Well, all we were told that there was this convoy coming over Chicks Bridge, and it was really amazing. This was the Nationalist Army withdrawing from Communist China. And this army had just about, it had everything, the families, the children, the chickens, the full sort of village life, I was going to say, but several villages. And the whole convoy, armed convoy, I remember passing through the new territories there. I was there, yes. And of course they ended up now as what is Taiwan, I suppose. I did have one, we had a chance when we were there to have a break, and I was given the opportunity to go to the Portuguese island,
Macau,
or to go up to Shanghai. And there was the Whitsun Bay. It was a British, I forget what they called them then, it wasn't a destroyer, it was smaller than a destroyer. The Whitsun Bay was going up there, and I thought, well, you know, go back to sea and get a little fresh air again and meet the Navy. And so I went on the Whitsun Bay up to Shanghai, and that's when the Americans were still there. That's before they'd withdrawn from there. And we went in. I don't know the reasons why we were up there, really. Because it was a very dicey time. The Nationalists were still in charge, but the Communists were more or less taking over. And we went ashore and had a game of football. I remember seeing the Americans with their... They'd taken over a whole hotel, and that was very posh, and they were certainly living it up there. There was several American warships up there. And we went to what used to be the Naffy there for a meal. And we sat down in this, I'm not quite sure it was the Naffy or the Fleet Club, it was something like that. Been a British club. And it's the first time in my life I've ever been asked to pay for a meal before they presented it. And I felt a bit insulted. But I thought, well, that's how far things have gone. You know, they wouldn't trust anybody. And before they brought a meal, you paid up. I thought that thing just stuck in my mind. Anyway, we sailed back. It was a very nice little interlude on, I guess, Whitsun Bay, yes. And it's a sloop, I think they call them. And we came back. Yes, we patrolled the islands. A lot of bandits still around. One time, Castle Peak Bay, I believe it's all hotels now, Castle Peak Bay was absolutely bare. We had a big tented camp at Castle Peak, and all these tents were canvas, laid out by the army. And we were there for a period of time, rest period. And we used to obviously do our patrols round the camp at night, just to keep off the pirates, really, and the looters and everybody else. And one night, and this is almost unbelievable, one night, the occupants of one tent woke up in the morning. The whole tent had gone. It had been lifted clean off the tent pole. These were big tents. There was about a dozen people inside. Big square tents. The complete tent had been lifted up. The garrotes had been cut silently, and the whole thing had been stolen. That's how crafty the Chinese can be. And what we used to see on the Chinese ships that went by...
Junks,
that's right, junks. These big patches of khaki in the middle. You couldn't help but laugh. They had a great sense of humour, the Chinese. And they could all speak pidgin English. And we always got on very, very well with them. They had no trouble speaking English. We could understand each other.